This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets reading their poems in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear from Amy Beeder.
Unfurl your thick invective, show your bullet head.
And from Haley Lighthouser with some poetry built from palindromes.
Was you ever bit by a dead bee?
We'll also hear Sandra Beasley read one of her poems. And David Trinidad will read from the work of the late Tim Dugos.
Then we'll talk with Kenneth Goldsmith about flarf and conceptual writing.
Somehow we're really hung up on originality in language.
This issue is more packed than usual because it's our summer issue. And for the past few years, we've called it our summer humor issue. But I guess last year we didn't. But not this year, right, Don? You came in and you put a put a serious stop to that.
Right. I'm a humorless person when it comes to poetry. One of the advantages of having a double issue is it's, of course, chock full of poems, many more poems than we can usually fit into a space. And we have poems from some familiar names like W.S. Merwin and Charles Simic, but also some people you may not know about. Elizabeth Ibers comes to mind, the first Afrikaans woman to publish a book of poems.
The issue also has lots of prose, as usual. There's a wonderful piece from Daisy Fried about reading Milton and giving birth. You wouldn't think those two things go together, but she makes them go together perfectly and humorously, as it turns out. Clive James has another essay. We've been running a series of his essays, and this one is about why we remember some good poets and forget others. He says, confidence is the attribute that can't be taught. Some people think about what you can teach poets and what you can't, and it made me think of Keats saying, be bold above all things.
Yeah, and he's his usual irascible self, and the essay starts off where he says, at a time when almost everyone writes poetry, but scarcely anyone can write a poem, it's hard not to wish for a return to some less accommodating era when the status of poet was not so easily aspired to. That'll set you straight.
Yeah. We've got a section called Poets We've Known, and there's some wonderful things in here, right, Don? You got this from Donald Revell, all his meetings with Creeley, which I especially liked.
Creeley is revered by so many people and was kind to so many people. Revell remembers their common ground in meeting places. You know, Creeley served in that role for, as Revell points out, several generations of American poets. And up to the very end, when one morning Donald Revell was feeling kind of down in the dumps, had a bad case of the blues, and emailed Creeley a passage from a book he was reading. And within an hour, Creeley replied and said, just back from a visit to not one but two family cemeteries. Small world. And appended to it a new poem, a small poem that ends with the lines, you got a song, man? Sing it. You got a bell, man? Ring it.
It's quintessential Creeley. He can just whip those things off. I remember talking to Donald Hall saying that Creeley would come over to his house and you know, they'd be sitting around talking, and suddenly Creeley would just write a poem right there on the couch. You know, he'd be writing. It was irritating to Don, you know, to suddenly be writing a poem.
I remember at a reading of Creeley's, the first time I saw him, it was hard to figure out where the poems stopped and his explanations began and the other way around. It was very lovely, cadenced speech, very memorable stuff. And we have other essays in this section too, Poets Remembering Poets. And one of the unusual bits is a long poem by John Cady remembering the New York poets of a certain era.
And he was close, still is close, with Ashbery, but he also knew Frank O'Hara and James Schuyler and Kenneth Koch. And he talks in a way that's nostalgic, but rigorous in a way.
Yeah, he sort of casts a cold eye back on those times and those people a little bit. And the piece itself is called 95th Street, so it's a funny little journey, I guess, from 2nd Avenue all the way to 95th Street in this poem, Looking Back.
Sandra Beasley appears for the first time in the magazine with three poems. Sandra Beasley won this year's Barnard Women Poets Prize for her book, I Was the Jukebox.
The poem we're going to hear now is called The Piano Speaks. Beasley says she wrote it on deadline as part of a project run by the Academy of American Poets called NAPORIMO, short for National Poetry Writing Month. Participants cranked out a poem a day during April, which is, of course, National Poetry Month.
When you're drafting a poem a day with a kind of informal midnight deadline, you find yourself accommodating such a breakneck pace by writing in series, by riffing.
In this case, Beasley started writing a series of poems from the perspective of inanimate objects.
I was actually on my balcony in my apartment in Washington, D.C., listening to a recording of Erik Satie. And I found myself thinking what the experience would be for the instrument after maybe having tolerated countless, you know, ragtime or happy birthday or whatever plunked out tune to be played by an artist so elegant, and how in a way that might change your expectations for the rest of your inanimate life, so to speak.
Here's Sandra Beasley reading The Piano Speaks after Erik Satie.
For an hour, I forgot my fat self, my neurotic innards, my addiction to alignment. For an hour, I forgot my fear of rain. For an hour, I was a salamander shimmying through the kelp in search of shore, and under his fingers, the notes slid loose from my belly in a long jelly rope of eggs that took root in the mud. And what would hatch, I did not know. A lie, a waltz, an apostle of glass. For an hour, I stood on two legs and ran. For an hour, I panted and galloped. For an hour, I was a maple tree. And under the summer of his fingers, the notes seeded and winged away in the clutch of small, elegant helicopters.
Well, that's such a beautiful, beautiful yeah. ending, isn't it? Yeah. Small, elegant helicopters. I mean, if you're going to write a poem after Erik Satie, it's got to be pretty whimsical and off the wall. I mean, Satie used to put things on his scores like to be played like a stabbed weasel. You know, so she's sort of in line with Erik Satie. The end of that is just wonderful, wonderful.
Well, the beginning's pretty good too. For an hour, I forgot my fat self,
my neurotic innards,
my addiction to alignment. That's actually very profound, I think, isn't it? You know, the piano in need of tuning, even when what's being played upon it is a piece that may be sort of detuned
right.
in some way. You have to have things aligned so you can untune them and do unusual things.
Well, if a poem like this is going to work, it has to work from a human level.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of those Marianne Moore poems like The Steamroller, or,
yeah.
you know, they begin to say something about human experience from the perspective of, say, a piano or a steamroller.
Yeah. At one point, the piano says, "For an hour, I stood on two legs and ran." It's sort of a marvelous miracle to imagine this piano on its two legs.
Yeah, who would think to write that?
Right? Yeah.
I mean, I when somebody tells me that they wrote a poem in a project like this, or writing a poem a day, my heart sinks usually, and I think, oh my God, that just seems dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it works for some people. This worked. This created a poem that seems to me really wonderful.
I think so, too. You know, it sort of brings the instrument and its wooden nature back to where it came from, the maple tree, you know, and the summer and the little helicopters, the seedlings that plant music all over the face of the earth.
Last month, we heard Michael Hoffman's withering invective in his poem Portrait of a Lady. In this issue, we are offered yet another approach to hurling insults by way of poetry, and this time it's from Amy Beeder.
Amy Beeder is the author of Burn the Field, and she teaches poetry at the University of New Mexico. In the poem we're about to hear, Beeder's inspired by a comic book character, Captain Haddock, from the Tintin series.
Tintin was created by the Belgian artist Georges Rémy in the 1940s. Captain Haddock is Tintin's best friend and is the stereotypical sea captain, short-tempered, volatile, he's always drinking whiskey. And, of course, to really fit the part, Haddock would have spoken with pretty colorful language.
And this was precisely Rémy's problem, because, as Amy Beeder reminds us, Tintin appeared in a children's magazine, so Haddock couldn't exactly let it rip.
Instead of using actual swear words, what Haddock delivers is a series of random but very specific words as insults, right, as though they were offensive. And some of my very favorite curses, he would call people ectoplasmic byproducts, and iconoclast is another favorite, platypus.
And so Beeder asked Captain Haddock to help her verbally assault an unlikely foe, the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association. Maybe not such an unlikely foe. But here's Amy Beeder reading Captain Haddock versus the PTA.
Bewildered saint of the curse, bulbous and profane, I invoke you against this nest of lice and vipers. O volcanic captain, I implore you, pour your scorn upon these Borgias. Before these braggarts, unfurl your thick invective. show your bullet head, whiskey pickled, weathered and pupilless, sweating in a bantam rage, your sad fish face a fist. Ostrogothic versus the matrons, fallible against the vampire's slander, because I would never say vivisectionist to her face. While you old Captain Fatstock, Hopscotch, Havoc, denouncer of bullies, knitters, and bandits, live to make the air around you frantic, to spill your black lake of cannibal ink.
I don't see how they can recover from this.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this is a perfect invective. You know, it reminds me actually of Roddy Lumsden, who I've been reading. We talked about, I think, on a couple of podcasts. Yeah. And the surprise of the language here, the sweating in a bantam rage, your sad fish face a fist, that confusion of metaphors, that conflation, you know, it's a fish and a fist together. It's, you know, bizarre, surreal.
Mm-hmm. And even the tone of it, you know, these Borgias, these braggarts. It's funny because the parent-teacher association would most likely be bewildered by these arcane references that wouldn't have turned up in their own education. So it's a good way to outdo them or outpace them.
It's over the top, deliberately over the top in its language. And it has a wonderful effect, I think.
Yeah, it reminded me a little of that 60s song, that Jeannie T. Riley song, you know, about the Harper Valley PTA.
Oh, right, yeah.
One-ups that song, too. And, of course, where it ends up with is the Black Lake of Cannibal Ink.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
We're publishing two poems this month by Haley Lighthouser, who has been writing a series of poems that contain palindromes. And you remember what palindromes are, right, Don?
Oh, yes. I had to
you're just writing,
consult my... No, it's those things. You remember them when you're a kid. You run across these things that work the same way backwards and forwards, like a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. If you record that and play it backwards, it says exactly the same thing.
Lighthouser says her interest in writing poems from palindromes began with an email from her brother.
He emailed me this wonderful palindrome, Red Rum, Sir, is Murder. And as soon as I heard it, I just loved it. I love the strange voice in it, and I love the intrinsic rhyme in it. When I first started writing them, I wrote Pot Top and Pin Nip and a couple silly little ones. But then once I got into the ones that were like sentence length, Yawn a More Roman Way, then I started seeing them everywhere.
Now, hearing these poems instead of reading them, it's going to be a lot harder to ferret out the palindrome that Lighthouser has tucked into them. So to keep you from listening only for the palindrome, we're going to give them away in advance. In the first poem, it's a very simple palindrome, Bad Dab. If you read it backwards, it's Bad Dab.
And the title of the poem, Was You Ever Bit by a Dead Bee, people might remember, comes from that wonderful movie of Hemingway's To Have and Have Not, where Walter Brennan plays the drunk old rummy guy on the fishing boat, and he keeps saying,
Was you ever bit by a dead bee?
I have no memory of ever being bit by any kind of bee.
Were you? Sticks in your head, as you'll see in this poem. Here's Haley Lighthouse reading, Was You Ever Bit by a Dead Bee?
Was you ever bit by a dead bee? I was, by its posthumous chomp, by its bad dab of venom, its joy buzzer buzz. If you ever shanked like the chump that I was, by the posthumous chomp of an expired wire, you'll bellow out prompt at the pitiless shiv when she does what she does. Was you? I was. By its posthumous chomp, by its bad dab of venom, its joy buzzer buzz.
This poem really does kind of read backwards and forwards. You know, these end words like chomp and buzz start off and end the poem and become interchangeable in your mind. They swim around in your head.
Yeah, I remember when I first read this poem, you know, in manuscript, and I think I may have told you, you know, I couldn't get this poem out of my head. It was just that, you know, I kept on saying these lines over and over to myself. You know, a poet has done something right when that happens.
Yeah, and palindromes really do come with a kind of built-in music, assonance, alliteration, consonants. A Lighthouser says that for her, they also act as a springboard for the rest of the poem.
The palindromes will either give me the subject for the poem, like Bad Dab gave me the idea of a bee sting, or it'll give me a tone of voice for the poem, as O Nat Tango did, giving me this very histrionic voice.
O Nat Tango, and that's O and Nat, the little creature, G-N-A-T, Tango, is part of a line in a poem called O She Says. Here's that poem read by Haley Lighthouser.
Oh, she says, because she loves to say oh. Oh, to this cloud break that ravels the night. Oh, to this moon, its mouthful of sorrow. O shallow grass and the nettle burr's bite. O to heart's flare, its wobbly satellite. O step after step in stumbling tempo. O owl and oak, O rout of black bat flight. O moaned an attic and Esperanto. O covetous tongue, O fat fandango. O gnat tango in the hot ochred light. O windward leaves and subtle inferno, O flexing of sea, O stars bolted tight. O ludicrous swoon, O blind hindsight, O torching of bridges and blood boiled white. O sparrow and arrow and hell below. O, she says, because she loves to say O.
You know, there's that story about Dylan Thomas and his writing shack overlooking the river, and he's sort of hung over looking out at things. And finally, after many hours of, you know, agonizing, he puts the letter O to the page, and then he goes off to the pub because that was a day's work for him. And so I thought of that when I saw this poem, and I figured maybe this is the end of the lyric O in English language poetry. After this, you know, there's nothing left to do with it.
Right. She's not mocking it necessarily, but she's responding to the tendency to mock that O.
Right.
You know, everyone says, well, you can't possibly do that in a poem. And it is very difficult to do it. And here she's done it so dramatically that she sort of reclaimed it for herself.
Well, and you know, it's hard to mess up rhymes with O, but the her choices are good. You know, sorrow, Esperanto is a good one, Fandango. Inferno.
Yeah, very
below.
Playful.
Yeah, it's funny, funny stuff. But I mean, on a serious level, the texture of the poem is really well wrought. I remember that when you look through Paradise Lost, you can see that Milton, whenever he was writing about the earth, always had O's buried and embedded in word after word in passages, just long passages. And it becomes a great fascination to see how you can get the language to actually, you know, embody something. So here, she says, well, what can you say with O? And she pulls out all the stops to say things.
And why does she do it? Simply because she loves to say O.
She loves
it has
to
some
say
kind
O.
of pure expression. Tim Dugos was active in the mass transit poetry scene in D.C. in the early 1970s and was also part of New York's downtown literary scene in the late 70s and 80s.
Dugos died in 1990, and Chicago poet David Trinidad has been putting together a comprehensive edition of his poems called A Fast Life, which Nightboat Books will publish in 2011.
You know, he was a friend of mine, and he actually said to me on his deathbed, you know, he asked me if I would look after his poems, which I gladly did. It sort of helped me process my grief to ensure that his poems got into print.
We asked Trinidad if he would read one of Dugos' poems that we're publishing in the issue called The Truth.
Dugos spent the last 2 years of his life studying for the Episcopalian priesthood at Yale Divinity School, and he wrote this poem during that period.
He was very concerned throughout his whole life and career with the notion of grace. It shows up again and again in his poems, so and here it is.
Here's David Trinidad reading The Truth by Tim Dugos.
Every time I use my language, I tell the truth. A cat in a white collar, like a priest with calico fur, walks across the dead grass of the yard and out through the white fence. The sun's strong, but the colors of the lawn were washed out by the winter, not the light. February, stained glass window of the house next door takes the sun's full brunt. It must look spectacular to the neighbor in my head, a white-haired woman with an air of dignity and grace, who through pools of the intensest colors climbs the flight of stairs. I've never seen it, but I know it's there.
This poem is like the others in this issue to some extent, and it takes very ordinary things and makes you, I don't want to say it discovers the extraordinary and the ordinary, that's a cliche and not a very helpful one. What it does is it takes very ordinary things and it somehow makes them into a lens that focuses beyond themselves.
Yeah. Lens is the right word too, especially in the middle of the poem where the stained glass window of the house next door takes the sun's full brunt. And he says, it must look spectacular to the neighbor in my head, a white-haired woman with an air of dignity and grace. That's just a fantastic concatenation of so many things in just a few spare lines, but the kind of things he has in his head and the light and the time of year and, of course, the spirituality of the sort of priest, you know, the cat in the white collar and the language and the truth. And where the poem ends up, and he says, still talking about the light from the stained glass window, he says, I've never seen it, but I know it's there, and you have to think which it is being referred to. Is it the stained glass window? Is it the neighbor? Is it the truth?
Yeah, that's the effectiveness of it.
Yeah.
That referent gets lost. And that's, yeah, it's moving to know that he wrote these poems late and that he was studying for the, I didn't realize that he was studying for the Episcopalian priesthood when he died. It makes you think of that Frost poem, For Once Then Something.
Yeah.
You know, what was that? The truth?
And yeah. For
Once Then Something.
Exactly. And also the strange recursiveness in the poem. Every time I use my language, I tell the truth.
Yeah.
That's the hard thing.
A few months ago at the Whitney Museum in New York City, Kenneth Goldsmith staged a fake war. This was a showdown, he claimed, between two trends to emerge in contemporary poetry, FLARF and conceptual writing. In the July-August issue, Goldsmith gives us a sampling of work from poets in both modes. Kenny Goldsmith is the founding editor of the website Ubu Web, and he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He also hosts the Avant Garde All the Time podcast, which is produced right here by the Poetry Foundation. He joins us today from New York. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, guys.
At the reading you organized at the Whitney, there were four FLARFists going toe-to-toe with four conceptualists. You were one of the conceptualists, but who won?
The FLARF always wins because they've got a much better name than we do.
Okay, now you're going to have to explain to our listeners, who may not be familiar with these things, what the difference is between FLARF and conceptual poetry.
Both are two movements that emerged over the past 5 years and formed in response to the question, what does it mean to be a poet in the age of the internet? They're two very different approaches. FLARF kind of dives in and tries to be as awful as it can. They do something called Google sculpting, which means finding the worst things they can possibly Google and then digging out even worse results. What happens in FLARF is that they're still using subjectivity. They're still deciding that what they're picking is the best, and they're putting it together, constructing it in almost traditional ways. But the fact of the matter is that what they've really ended up with, they haven't written very much of themselves. So it's very, very complicated. Now, conceptual writing is much drier, much cut and dried. The conceptualists simply build a machine and let the language flow through it. They don't feel responsible or attached to the results of those poems. They're simply interested in constructing a good machine.
And both of these movements are designed to counteract the unintentional awfulness of ordinary poetry?
Well, awfulness is in the ear of the beholder.
In quotation marks, in italics.
Yes, we don't call them awful. We just actually think that these are contemporary ways of working with language, mirroring the way that we deal with language every day, which is really just a matter of moving information from one place to another. Conceptual writing often feels that there's enough language in the world that we don't need to write anymore. We just need to learn to manage the amount of existing language.
Well, let's hear one of your conceptualist pieces, Kenny, and the issue that we've got two poems from your series called The Day, which is a transcription of every word from the New York Times from September 11th, 2001. I'm sure everyone will recognize that day. Would you mind reading a Metropolitan Forecast for us?
Sure. I just wanted to also mention that in retyping the 9/11 newspaper, most people think that it's the 9/12 newspaper, the one that was actually reporting on the events of the day. But this is the newspaper that was printed the day of 9/11. So there's complete ignorance of what's going to happen, or more importantly, what's not going to happen during that day. So this is the paper people had with them going to work that day. It's called Metropolitan Forecast, D8L. The New York Times, Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. Metropolitan Forecast, today, less humid sunshine, high 79. Noticeably less humid air will filter into the metropolitan region on. Brisk winds from the northwest, high pressure building east from the Great Lakes will promote mainly sunny skies. Daytime daytime readings will peak in the lower 80s. Tonight, clear, lighter winds, low 62. Skies will be clear overnight as high pressure crests near the middle Atlantic coast. Humidity will remain low and temperature will fall to around 60 degrees in many spots. Tomorrow, mainly sunny, high 76. Sunshine and just a few clouds will fill the sky. Breezes will turn and blow from the south ahead of a cold front approaching from Canada.
Metropolitan Forecast is just part of a book that, as we said, contains the entire New York Times, word for word, from September 11, 2001. But this is the second time you've transcribed an entire issue of the New York Times. The first was in your 900-page book, Day, from the issue published on Friday, September 1, 2000, a day with totally different context, I guess, from September 11th. Is context everything here?
Context is always everything. The first book was done on a slow news day, a nothing day. It was sort of normal life. And in retyping it, the normal became extraordinary. And the book is an extraordinary document of the mundane. I decided to take the identical process and apply it to a day in which everything happened, in which every word is loaded. And yet I'm not doing anything different, but the emotional register obviously is quite heightened on the September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, at the end of the poem you just read, it's chilling. I mean,
everything is chilling.
Right, exactly. Just because of the context. Yeah.
Absolutely. So you can actually take an uncreative approach to different material and come up with different tonalities and different emotional registers by doing absolutely nothing but reframing. There's no creativity. You see,
there's some.
Absolutely.
Well,
none. There's
only you had to make decisions about, you know, how to position these things though, right?
There's just decisions, but no creativity.
Right.
All of the genius goes into the front loading, as it were. And then the process by which the words get written are merely mechanical. So if the machine is good and if it's constructed well and you choose something great, the content is going to sing. Otherwise, it'll be a complete failure. Mm-hmm. One could go and retype the entire world and not come up with anything good.
Right. So it's a good thing those guys at the New York Times know what they're doing.
Yeah, I sent the copy of Day to the New York Times hoping to get sued because I was absolutely, you know, totally ripping off their content. And I can imagine that it arrived in the book review department and they looked at it and they probably said, this is just a piece of madness, and threw it in the recycling bin.
Let's listen to one of the Flarfists in this issue. Gary Sullivan is one of the founders of Flarf, actually, and we have in the issue a comic strip he wrote.
The version in the magazine and the version we're about to hear are different, but close enough to give you a sense of the work. Here's Gary Sullivan reading an excerpt from Am I Emo, recorded a few months ago at the Whitney.
Am I emo? Is the word emo bad? Is there emo pandas? Why am I called emo? Girls, why do you like poetry? What is poetry really about? Is emo a white trash trend? Is it possible to be original? How is emo poetry differentiated? Do emo people hate cars or something? Does poetry have to be about emotion? Why is it against the law to hit an emo? Is personal poetry bad, in your opinion? What are the small steps to becoming emo? Is dating an emo guy emotionally draining? What is your opinion of emo pants on guys? How do I dress like a classy emo to church? How does a fact-oriented person write poetry? How do I get my hair to do that flippy emo thing? Why do people always stand, emo people, in ballet positions? Is it normal for a 14-year-old boy to write poetry? Help me. How do I look goth emo without my mom noticing? If an emo hippie cuts him herself, do rainbows come out?
That was Gary Sullivan reading an excerpt from his poem, Am I Emo? So, Kenny, would you say that this is a typical Flarf poem?
I would say it's a typical Flarf poem. It's typical in the fact that Gary is using the first-person subjective without him meaning it or having written that at all. It's all found, and so he takes it on, and by reading it, and particularly during the reading, I mean, you can hear the audience reaction. It's absolutely hysterical because Gary's a guy pushing 50 who's certainly not embodying what we think of as being an emo kid. And yet there's something very smart about it, because Gary has chosen very wisely. He's chosen something terribly. This could really be a disaster. It could be not funny. But because he's so good, he can actually choose things that are, in my opinion, right on.
You know, some people seem to be offended by Flarf poems. We've already been getting some emails and letters about them, because the poets, as part of their technique, tend to spread around what might be considered by some people grotesque or ethically questionable language, like the stuff about Hitler in Nada Gordon's poem, Unicorn Believers Don't Declare Fatwas. What do you think about this? I mean, is the writer a passive medium, or, I mean, is this something that is part of the point that's being made? I mean, just help people understand what it is that they're reacting to and maybe how they could feel differently mm-hmm. about it.
Well, you know, I think the job of contemporary art is to reflect the contemporary world in which we live. And, you know, the world of the web is not a clean and antiseptic, savory place. It's a I believe that there's a great deal of realism in these works, and that's something, and even populism. It's something actually using a very populist language that may be offensive, but in fact is the type of language that's used all the time. So we don't normally mm-hmm. think of avant-garde as being somewhat populist. But I'd also would say that there's nobody in the world that can't understand that Nada Gordon poem. These poems are all completely understandable.
I guess we should listen now to another conceptualist poem, just for balance. Here's one by Caroline Bergvall called The Knot Tail Funeral. So, Kenny, can you tell us a bit about Caroline Bergvall and how she went about making this poem?
Yeah, Caroline Bergvall is a transnational global citizen. And Caroline often slides into different languages, just even in conversation. And her take on Chaucer, because it's sort of proto-English, English being formed, is full of other languages. So it's a perfect target for her to kind of do almost a Cagean write-through linguistically and pick out things that are English, but in fact are reframed so differently as to make us wonder if in fact they really are.
And help us understand, before we hear it, how this thing was put together.
Well, it was very simply created by translating and excerpting the negatives that make up Chaucer's description of the funeral in the
Knight's Tale. Yeah.
Right, of the Canterbury Tales.
Here's Caroline Bergvall reading The Knot Tale Funeral.
The great labor of appearance served the making of the pyre. How they shall not be told, nor how the gods, nor how the beasts and birds, nor how the ground aghast, nor how the fire first with straw, and then with dry, and then with green, and then with gold, and how a site is laid like this. Nor what, nor how, nor how, nor what she spoke, nor what was her desire, nor what jewels, when the fire, nor how some threw there, and some there, and cups full of wine, milk, and blood, into the fire, nor how three times, and three times with, and three times how, and how that, nor how, nor who, I cannot say, nor can I tell, but shortly to the point I turn and give my tale an end.
How would you say, what would you say is the effect of this poem? How is one meant to respond to it?
Well, I mean, I think the first way to respond to it, listening and reading, are so beautiful because what's spoken and what's printed are absolutely different. And it's a testament to the multidimensionality of English. And I think Old English really does have those things that kind of throw you, like into the fear, F-Y-R, and then into the fire. And you're not quite sure if F-Y-R is fear, as in being afraid, or it's a Old English version of fire. And Caroline pronounces them quite differently, so they have two different meanings. But on the page, we're not really sure. Unless, of course, we're Old English scholars, which I'm not.
Now, you teach a class called Non-Creative Writing, Kitty, in which you don't allow your students to write anything original. All the language must be found, as in the piece that you read for us. As you're thinking there, that there's already so much stuff out there with the internet and other technologies that what we really need are different ways to order it and look at it rather than sort of new ways of creating.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I think the visual art world, you know, dealt with this a century ago with Marcel Duchamp's reframing of everyday objects such as a urinal. And yet somehow in writing, we haven't really gotten to that. Every other field of culture seems to have accepted the fact that framing something or reframing it can make us see something very differently. Certainly we have sampling in music. And yet somehow we're really hung up on originality in language.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. One of the emails we got was from a reader who looked at Mel Nichols' FLARF poem, I Google Myself, which starts off, I Google myself. I want you to love me. When I feel down, I want you to Google me. And complained that this was just appropriation from the Divinyls, I Touch Myself. And said, didn't the editors know that when they saw this poem? What's wrong with them?
I think it's so interesting that actually poetry can still offend. And that's unusual because, you know, Jeff Koons or Madonna, I mean, nobody is offended by these things. They're kind of cliches. And yet appropriation in poetry still has the potential to get people upset. And so therefore, it seems to me that there's still quite a bit of work to be done in this field.
You know, you say that there's the fact that there's an avant-garde in poetry today shows how conservative poetry is in comparison to other art forms. That's sort of what you're saying, that we're 50 years behind visual art. And I'm interested, you blame this on the critics rather than on the poets. So when would you say the critics stopped keeping up, and why was that?
Well, the fact is that we still have two very distinctive streams in American poetry. We still have the mainstream and we still have the avant-garde. I'm not sure the point of disjunction. I don't think it ever, you know, I don't think that the avant-garde, so to speak, ever really did have occupy a mainstream position and kind of lost it. I think people have been working all along writing this type of work, but I think the exposure has been extremely limited.
Well, now that it's getting some exposure, I guess the inevitable question is, are these movements here to stay? Are people going to be reading anthologies of early 21st century FLARF and conceptual poems, you know, 50 years, 100 years from now? Or are they meant to be kind of ephemeral?
Well, I think it's both. I don't think that we're going to experience the same kind of canon forming as, you know, we can't expect anthologies that last for 50 years. There's a sort of temporariness to reputation, to careers. There's a sliding, there's a form changing, there's a shape shifting. That's all a part of the way that language and poetry and information is received today. I do believe, though, that these works will be viewed as works, very early attempts to hammer out, again, the answer to the question, what does it mean to be a poet in the internet age? And I really don't think these are questions that have been tackled yet, and I think these movements are actually attempting it. You know, whether they are the ultimate answer, I actually don't think they're the ultimate answer. I actually think we can't possibly conceive of what the ultimate answer will be, but the poet Christian Book, who's also in this issue, has proposed that in the future, machines will write poems to be read by other machines, and that will be the great readership and authorship of poetry.
That'll make our job a lot easier.
That's right, yeah. I mean, he might think we're already doing that, actually.
In this issue, perhaps. But I think one thing that that we're talking about here, that there is a great deal of human intervention. There is a great deal of touch. There is a great deal of authorial intention here, even though everything sort of seems like it might be mechanical and it might be appropriated. In fact, there's a great deal of traditional craft and traditional care going into these poems. So I think they have one foot in the past, really, and they have one foot in the future.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Kenny.
Yeah, Kenny, thanks a lot. This really makes things a lot clearer for us, for our readers, and it's exciting to think about what's going to come next.
Okay, guys, thank you very much.
You can read Kenneth Goldsmith's introduction to and selections of FLARF and conceptual writing and everything else you've heard on this program in the July-August issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.